Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Barack Obama got our patriotism firing last year when he said the world needs more Canada. Sure, that may be true when it comes to healthcare and comedians, but it might not be the case when it comes to investing. Just the opposite, in fact. Canada needs more world. That's according to Terry Shaughnessy of Shaughnessy Investment Counsel. We'll talk to him to hear what he means. Then, the massive data breach at credit bureau Equifax has put the spotlight back on hackers. There are many companies that stand to lose from increasing crime, but some that stand to gain. We'll hear about a new exchange-traded fund that focuses on cybersecurity stocks. And we'll follow that conversation with some perspective on how to protect yourself from fraud. Cybersecurity expert Dr. Tom Keenan will be our guest. Plus, do millennials need financial advisors, really? I'll ask a millennial financial advisor that question. How to sell the service when your target market doesn't have a lot of savings and may have a lot of debt. There's lots ahead. Let's get started. Is there such a thing as too much Canada? Too much beauty? No. Too much poutine? No. Too much snow? Yes. Too much Justin Bieber? Yes, for sure, yes. Our next guest argues that when it comes to investing, it's possible to have too much Canada. Terry Shaughnessy is the president of Shaughnessy Investment Counsel. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here,
Too
Bruce.
Much Justin Bieber, you think? Is it possible? That one, you're
never.
Never, never. So what is your beef with Canada? Canadian stocks, the Canadian market, and I'm magnifying the point. Right. I know it's not necessarily a beef, but why is it a risk?
Well, the risk is that there's two risks. One is that, you know, when you look at stocks, or we'll call them equities around the world, just in the big markets like the in New York S&P 500, in London the EAFE index, which is the big blue chip index there, the sum of those other big indexes are about 95% of the market value of stocks worldwide. So Canada, first of all, only represents about 4 or 5% of total stocks outstanding. And I would guess that most Canadians have at least half to three quarters of their portfolio in Canadian equities. So first of all, they're considerably overweighted in Canadian stocks. The other thing is that unlike our friends to the south, where you have a big tech business with very exciting companies in there like Apple and Facebook and Amazon, Canada has dominated 35% of our market cap is really in financial services, which have done a fantastic job. About 20-25% is in energy, and the other sort of 15 or 20% is in materials, primarily gold stocks. So it's a very narrow market for Canada and doesn't actually reflect the Canadian economy. The Canadian economy is very service-oriented, but those kinds of stocks are not listed on the TSX composite.
And if you remove those tech stocks, you could almost say that there's no way you've got growth in your portfolio, just in terms of distinguishing growth and value. Canadian banks, energy, all that could fit a value moniker, but nothing in terms of growth.
Yeah, there's nothing in terms of growth. In the past, it has been resources that we relied on for growth, and obviously for changes in pricing of energy, and also social convention has radically changed the outlook for the growth of energy.
Why do you think that is? Why are Canadians overweight Canada? Is it a hangover from the old RRSP rules? Can't even remember when those changed, but a while ago there were Canadian requirements on that front. Or is it just going with what we know?
It's the second. Home bias is what this is called. Home bias is noticeable in the United States. Like if you ask American investors, they have S&P 500. They almost have nothing like overseas.
Right.
So this is not limited to just Canada. The difference is in the United States, at least your S&P 500 is worth half, whereas ours is worth 5%, right? So a home bias in the U.S. is not the end of the world.
And many of those companies in the S&P 500 would have international operations. They wouldn't serve a domestic market.
That's true. And the same is true really in the international indexes as well, where like the number one stock is like Nestle in Switzerland, but it's a food company worldwide. That's the most valuable stock in the market over there.
So take us through a sort of model asset mix that includes Canada, but also includes Europe, EFI, S&P 500. What's your starting point?
The starting point would be because we come from the institutional world, so big pension plans, foundations, you start with what's called a benchmark portfolio. And that would be a portfolio that would be roughly 5% in cash, like treasury bills or certificates of deposits, 35% in the Canadian bond index, and then 20% in Toronto Stock Exchange, 20% composite, 20% in the S&P 500 Canadian dollars, and 20% in the EAFE index, which stands for Europe, Australasia, and the Far East.
What's in EAFE? I don't know if I'm pronouncing the acronym, but I often pronounce it that way. But what kind of names are in there?
Right. Well, the EAFE is basically every big company that is not listed in the United States or headquartered in the United States is in that index. So it is things like, as I just mentioned, Nestle, the food company. It's also GlaxoSmithKline, the drug company. It'll be Toyota. It'll be HSBC, the bank. Shell Oil. These are all the big, big names. And Toyota and Honda and things like that as well.
It doesn't include small caps. How do you think about small caps? Do you care about exposure to small caps?
For us, at our particular shop, small cap is an area that is best handled, especially in Canada, is best handled by an active manager, because a small cap or a small company has got its risks involved in it. The biggest one of which is managerial risk. It's really who's running the company, like their ability to outthink their competitors. Also, their talent in terms of being able to attract capital to themselves. These are real art and talent to this, and that needs observation. So unlike large cap stocks, which are becoming more and more efficient, there is still an inefficiency of information among small cap companies.
The approach that you've laid out is very, very simple. How do you sell that? Don't clients want a more complicated story? Don't they want like t-shirt cannons and skywriting and here's how we do this? Because it sounds like you're kind of, it's like the read and write and arithmetic, the who, what, where, why. It sounds very simple.
Right. It is actually that simple. The hardest thing for individuals, if you try to run your own money, you can buy exchange-traded funds that track these four asset classes that I've just mentioned. The hardest thing is to keep your emotions out of it. So if you think you can keep your emotions out of it, you could take the simplest possible route, which is just to buy the four ETFs in the categories I just mentioned, and on your birthday, rebalance back to that 60-40 split.
Isn't this advice the fastest way for you to go out of business?
Well, because
I'm only partly kidding.
Well, it is going to change the industry entirely. We use a combination of asset. Our weightings in the asset mix is what allows us to basically outperform the benchmark by about 1% net of our fee. So our ability to manipulate the asset mix is really what
that's your value add.
That's our value added. And so just think about it. It's like a recipe. You should think of asset mix just like if you're making a cake, you have all the same ingredients that any other cook would have. And it's how you combine those ingredients that makes your cake taste better than somebody else's.
How are you thinking about the U.S. stock market these days? Has the Trump presidency changed things for you from an investing standpoint?
Not really. He's quite apart from whatever opinion you may have of Trump, and we theoretically don't have an opinion on this guy. I mean, he's not a credit really to the United States, but in actual fact, he's not a detriment to the financial market. So we don't really think that he'll do anything untoward. And in fact, he could actually surprise everyone by perhaps doing something, being successful at least on one thing, like say bring corporate taxes down or bring regulation down, because he does have the Goldman Sachs team in there. So that gives us some hope. But mostly on the S&P 500, the American stock market, we've been heavily oriented towards that stock market for the last 3 years, and we're just starting to reduce our exposure to U.S. stocks in favor of moving to the international side. Hmm.
Now, you and I have been talking about ETFs for a decade, mm-hmm. but I think it bears repeating. Tell us about that as a structure, and tell us about how a regular retail investor can do what you have proposed.
Well, for the regular retail investor, the real value of an exchange-traded fund is that it will give you the rate of return of the asset class that you choose. So let's just make it easy. If we say that I want to get the rate of return of the TSX composite, you can buy an ETF from iShares, to use an example, XIC, listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, And just by holding that, you'll get the rate of return of the – you don't have to do anything else. But the fee on that is extremely low. So you don't have to pay a lot of outside managers. And the same is true if you think of these big levers like TSX Composite, S&P 500, which most people are familiar with, and then the EAFE, EFI index that we keep talking about, the international one.
You've recently announced a partnership with Wealthsimple. It is an example of a robo-advisor, of which there are a number in this country, Invisor, Wealthbar, Nest, there's a bunch of them. How does that work?
Well, our relationship with Wealthsimple is a new one. And prior to this, because we are what's known as a boutique, we're a small shop, can only deal with a few number of clients, even though we can manage lots of money. And so with Wealthsimple, it allows us to make available to the public a portfolio that we use for our First Nations clients. So we have four First Nations, about 125 million. It is in an institutional composite. So it's very similar to that benchmark portfolio of 20-20-20 and 35% bonds that I've just mentioned. It's the ratios are a little bit different. And that has allowed us to have pretty good performance over the last couple of years. But now that's available to really anyone through the Wealthsimple platform, whereas in the past, in order to be a client of ours, you had to have a minimum of $5 million. And it wasn't so much of
what we were... Who doesn't have $5 million?
Yeah,
this is an easy threshold.
This is Toronto.
Come on,
sell a garage in the back, you get $5 million bucks. No, but it wasn't so much that it's complicated. It's just that we couldn't deal with a lot of people. We didn't have a structure that allowed us. But Wealthsimple allows us to reach everyone. And we think this is a good structure for most people. We think this is certainly for an RRSP, this is what you'd want.
Well, and there's been a huge amount of buzz for the robo-advisor category. One of the advantages on ETFs versus doing it yourself with a discount broker is as you accumulate cash, even if your trading fees are relatively low on the ETF, it can be cost prohibitive to reinvest that cash. There's no way to do that really simply. If you're with a big discount broker, you're still paying $9.99.
Correct. That's correct. Yeah. So this is a much better setup.
Now, I want to come back to this Canada bias here. Mm-hmm. Aside from our conversation, how do you think this gets addressed? How do we alter the way Canadians think about it?
Well, I think most of it is just on performance. I think already it's amazing how many individuals have already made the step out to the U.S. equity markets over the last couple of years. They became more confident in their abilities. And also the convenience of using an exchange-traded fund allowed them to just buy the S&P 500. This is a particular year where the international index, EAFE, is doing considerably better than anything in North America.
One last question, Terry. You're based in Calgary and have been for some time now. What insight would you provide for our listeners on what's going on for the energy sector there and the prospects for a rebound in energy stocks in particular?
Well, we actually think that energy industry in Canada has probably bottomed out. And in fact, just in August, we bought our first position in the energy index in Canada. It's the first we've been in there for a long time, simply because we don't expect oil to take off. But the Suncor's and Canadian Natural Resources that make up the bulk of the energy index have done a very good job of operating profitably, even under these low prices. So we think in the future, they'll continue to do well.
Yeah. Terry, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Appreciate it. Terry Shaughnessy, Shaughnessy Investment Counsel. Coming up later on Moo La La, millennials roll their eyes when they hear us Gen Xers talk about the good old days of cable TV, landlines, and newspapers. The question that the asset management industry wants to answer is, will they have the same disinterest in financial advice? We're going to talk about that with a millennial financial advisor. But next, what do exchange-traded funds and shampoo have in common? Too much choice. Dry, damaged, oily, frizzy, dry scalp, repair and protect, age-defying. Ugh. What about just a simple shampoo for normal hair? Soon we'll be asking the same question on ETFs. That's coming up. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moo La La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Gender diversity and cybersecurity. It is really, really hard to make a link between these two things unless you consider the exchange-traded fund market. Two separate ETFs that focus on these two separate areas have just come onto the market. Raj Lala is the president and CEO of Evolve Funds. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There was this restaurant in Toronto, I think in the 80s, called Ginsburg and Wong, which was a, do you remember this one?
Yes.
Jewish deli and Chinese food at the same place. Weird, but delicious. Is there a connection between these two things?
I think that the common connection between these two would really be that they both fit into an ESG type of portfolio, which stands for environmental, social, and governance, or, you know, some people call it socially responsible investing. Gender diversity is about governance, and so is cybersecurity. I would say that that would be the common thread. Is there a commonality between some of the positions in the portfolio? No.
The ticker, let's do the gender diversity one first. The ticker is HERS, yeah. H-E-R-S. I love that. What's the objective?
The objective is to actually invest in large cap, blue chip, North American companies that have been the most proactive as it relates to gender diversity.
And how do you measure that? I mean, I have some ways that I think you might use, but you tell me.
Yeah, we've partnered up with an organization out of Europe called Equileap. And they're a non-for-profit organization. And really what they have done is put together the entire methodology that is used to rank these companies. So they would start with 3,000 large cap global companies. And then they would take a look at multiple criteria. So they would start at percentage of women at the board level, percentage of women in management, percentage of women in the workforce, all the way down to HR policies. And then from that universe, they whittle it down to about 1,000 of the higher ranking companies. And then they actually submit a questionnaire to those 1,000 companies to actually get feedback on how proactive those organizations are from a gender diversity perspective.
So they might be promoting networking groups or leadership programs for women or those kinds of things that are more qual in nature that are harder to read from a financial statement.
Correct. So there's an element of quant, there's an element of qualitative. And then the 150 that are the highest ranking is what makes up this ETF.
What are some of the names that are in that 150?
So we've got just over 25 Canadian companies, and the balance is U.S.-based. A lot of the usual suspects, very well-known names that many of your listeners would be familiar with. In
For
Canada,
example,
you've got all the banks that are part of the portfolio. You have some of the utilities like Enbridge, like Suncor. You've got gold companies like Kinross. You've got some mining companies like Lundin, and then some others that are part of the portfolio as well. With the U.S., the usual suspects as well. You've got organizations like Eli Lilly. You've got the banks in the U.S. as well, and you've got some of the utilities.
How
also.
Does tech fare? There has been so much controversy about gender diversity and indeed some horrific behavior in the U.S. Are there big names there that that are either notably present or notably absent?
Yeah, I mean, when you just purely look at the quantitative side in terms of, you know, the percentage of women represented at the board level and management and staff, tech's actually made quite a bit of progress in the U.S. So we do have, you know, positions, for example, in Google, even though I know everybody is aware of the memo that was sent around. But from a quantitative perspective, I mean, that's one bad apple or a couple of bad apples can't really spoil the entire bunch. So there is some tech representation, but I would completely agree with you. It is underrepresented. Engineering companies are somewhat underrepresented with a female workforce as well. Those are two of the areas that probably need to make a little more progress as it relates to gender diversity.
How does the list get updated? Do they do that screen every single year on an ongoing basis?
Correct.
So, and what kind of churn would you expect of those 150 companies? Any idea how many would come in or out every year?
Yeah, we're going through a rebalance right now, and I can't talk too much about the portfolio because the rebalance hasn't taken place.
Yeah,
but there's quite a bit of changes that have actually taken place. And it doesn't necessarily mean that organizations have fallen in their gender ranking. It just means that some other organizations have moved up in their gender ranking.
Which means they've fallen in their gender ranking. The net result is the same.
On a relative basis.
Exactly. One of the things that shocked me was the Canadian numbers on female board representation, like the binary number. Well, the last time I looked at it, it was something like 100 of the top 500 companies in this country did not have one female director. Do you have a sense that companies are awakening to the fact that they can, in some ways, just game the system on that particular variable, like, you know, open the door? make some progress.
Yeah, I mean, our regulators are also moving towards greater transparency in terms of the percentage of women at the board level. I mean, in Canada, you're at about 24-25%. There's a goal to get to 30%. We have an organization here in Canada called the 30% Club, which is advocating greater board representation. I think that that is, you know, just one element of it all. I think it's important to be able to actually bring greater gender diversity up through the workforce to eventually get to that board level. Because many times you see individuals looking at the top ranks, right? Do you have a female president and CEO? Do you have good board representation from a female perspective or management? But in order to get to those levels, a lot of times you just need to have a really good gender balanced workforce. I mean, you look at the banks, for example, you go into a branch and you will see a lot more females than you will males. Yet once it starts to get to middle management, you start to see a drop off in the percentage of females that get that actually move up. Now, that could be for a number of reasons. But I think what's important to look at is the entire vertical of an organization and not just the percentage of women on the board.
CYB, cybersecurity. Tell us about the methodology on that one.
So CYBR.
CYBR. So I'm sorry. Thank you.
Cyber. The thesis behind it is really simple. I think at the end of the day, everyone agrees that the amount of cyber attacks or cyber crime is not going to decrease over the next 5 or 10 years. It's going to increase. Therefore, investing in some of the companies out there that are the most versed as it relates to providing the consulting services, providing the hardware, and providing the software support to combat cyber crime should end up doing well. You know, one of the companies in our portfolio, for example, right now is front and center as it relates to the Equifax hack, because they're in there right now cleaning up or helping clean up that entire organization. So, you know, cybersecurity is a very interesting area of the market because you can parallel it almost to a house, which is, you know, we get a security system in our house to potentially prevent somebody from entering into our house. And then, of course, you've got cybersecurity that fills into that. And then you've got, if somebody does break into your house, what do you actually do? That's part of cybersecurity. And then once they've broken in, they've taken things from your house, the forensic side of it is trying to figure out what they took, how they took it, and how to prevent it from happening again. So it's very much like the whole house analogy as it relates to our home security system.
I used to work in packaged goods marketing. And one of the things that we found out was that total volume rose when we reduced the selection on the shelf. And sometimes we talk about shampoo, just simplify it for people. How will you know when the market has hit saturation on exchange-traded funds? Because there are so many there.
There's a lot, more than 500 right now. I'll tell you, when I was putting Evolve together, most people told me I was crazy to go and set up an ETF business because it's way too crowded, way too saturated. And I agree with them. But it's crowded and saturated at the core. I don't think we in Canada need another TSX 60 ETF. We don't need another Dow Jones 30 ETF. But there's an element of the ETF business that is either underserved or unserved. So some of these thematics, like the cybersecurity, the gender diversity, those are first of their kind in Canada. And although they're thematic, it doesn't mean that they're niche, because oftentimes we use the two terms interchangeably. I mean, the average market cap in our North American gender diversity, the average market cap of the underlying security is over $70 billion. And the average market cap for our cybersecurity is over $8 billion. I mean, these are fairly large organizations. This isn't something that can necessarily just make up 1% or 2% of investors' portfolios. So I think if you're going to have success in the ETF world, you need to be creative and you need to be innovative. I've been around for a while, so I remember the mutual fund industry of the 1990s. Everybody said the same thing. Why do you want to get into the mutual fund industry? It's so crowded. And the truth is, if you come up with good quality products that fulfill an investment thesis and you execute a good business plan, you can still have success.
There are lots of different angles to the socially responsible investing theme. I interviewed the founder of the Trump ETF recently. MAGA is the ticker, Make America Great Again. And that ETF was a real reflection of his worldview and his values. As you look at the options available to you to launch different products in this realm, do they reflect your personal values or do they reflect a market opportunity?
Both. Definitely both.
Are you going to launch a competitor to MAGA, a Trump ETF?
No.
No. Why not?
In order for me to actually go out there and talk about a product, I absolutely need to believe in it. But I also need to be able to see the investment case and also see the market opportunity. So on the gender diversity, I mean, I'm a male, obviously, as you can tell by my voice. I actually think it's really important for male engagement in gender diversity because males are what's going to really help make the changes in management at organizations to push it down and to make sure that gender diversity is a priority. I have two daughters, and I want to make sure that when they enter into the workforce in 10 years from now, that they get treated equally, that they enter into an organization where they feel that they've got just as much chance as a male of getting promoted throughout the organization. As it relates to cybersecurity, I mean, I personally think that the thesis is so simple. I think there's going to be increased demand for cybersecurity firms. We're going to have way more hacks over the next 5 or 10 years and threats and crime, and they're evolving as well. I mean, gone are the days of the blue screen of death, as we remember from viruses or the worms or Trojan horses. Now it's malware, it's ransomware. You know, the hackers have figured out ways to actually generate revenues from hacking in and taking your personal
It's brilliant.
Records.
I mean, it's horrible, but it is also brilliant in that way.
Because there was no real economic model before from putting these Trojans into your computer and freezing it up.
Yeah.
Right?
You have filed a prospectus for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I know that restricts you in terms of what you can speak about, but I want to ask you why this was interesting to you. And broadly speaking, what's actually going to be in it? Because it's not – you can't do a filter on companies that use Bitcoin and buy shares in an equity. It's going to be more nuanced or complex than that. So why and what's in it?
Yeah, we filed it last week. It's filed as, you know, if we obtain approval from the regulators, it should be the first Bitcoin ETF in Canada. Our view is, I don't know if you've ever tried to buy Bitcoin before. I have tried.
There's the answer. No.
Yes, I have tried. It's a very daunting task. It's a scary task. You're not really sure if you're dealing with reputable providers. There is a huge subset of the market right now that is looking for exposure into Bitcoin. So we felt that it was important to deliver something that would be a more acceptable way for individuals to track the price of Bitcoin.
Last word to you. You offer hedged and unhedged versions. How come?
Because I think that it's important for individuals to be able to have a choice in terms of currency, which way the investment's actually going to work for them. So they have the ability to hedge out currency risk if they want to actually purely look at the underlying portfolio from an investment perspective and not have the noise of currency play in place. So for some people, they take a view on hedging currency in terms of their investment advisors. For others, they don't take a view and believe in owning stocks based on their base currency. So you have both options. They're both the same fee. There's no extra fee for one versus the other.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Raj.
Thank you, Bruce.
Raj Lala is the president and CEO of Evolve Funds. Coming up later, the Moolala questionnaire. But next, how to stop the scammers. Cybersecurity expert Tom Keenan will be here with his tips. And I have some tips too. I'm the money columnist for CityLine. You can check out our segments at cityline.tv. Then search for me, Bruce Sellery. Instantly, the show has just been picked up in the U.S., so we're everywhere. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Sellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The massive security breach at Equifax has put cybersecurity on the front page again. In that case, there was absolutely nothing you could have done to prevent getting hacked. But in other cases, there is, including using your credit card. I know, counterintuitive, right? Dr. Tom Keenan is a cybersecurity expert, professor at the University of Calgary, and the author of Techno Creep. We taped this conversation back in March, but I thought it was worthy to re-air today. I started by asking him why he favors credit cards over debit cards when it comes to security.
Well, let's start out with there are advantages to debit cards. You're never going to spend money you don't have.
Right.
So that when you run out of your account, you're not going to get a big bill at the end of the month. That's the big advantage. But the other side of it is your money. So if the bad guys got a hold of that card and somehow compromise it, they can siphon down your bank account. Now, they can run up your credit card bill, too. But then it's a little different because it's not exactly your money. It's money you sort of owe to the credit card company, but they'll come and fight for you. They will try to help deal with the fraud. I'm not saying the banks won't on the debit card, but you're already in the position that your money is gone and you're fighting to get it back. That's the key problem.
How do the rules differ between the two? So there's been a lot of talk lately about people's PINs, right? You are never supposed to tell anyone your PIN. Don't leave it anywhere close to your card. Our credit cards have PINs and our debit cards have PINs. Do the rules differ on that front?
The technology is pretty similar. And when we went to chip and PIN in Canada, everybody got a new thing in the mail that nobody read that said, by the way, that's not true.
Everybody read it. They framed it and put it up in their kitchen.
Exactly. Right next
to the shopping list.
And the thing said, now if your PIN number is used, that's evidence that it was you. And there actually was a very famous case in Toronto, Canada, where this fellow denied a credit card charge. It happened to be for a sports car for $85,000. He said, I didn't do it. And it got to be a big dispute with a big Canadian bank. And I did follow the case for a while. And then I heard that he was arrested for fraud in another country. So basically, your PIN is your signature. It's giving the authority. That's why the bank will, if they find out that you wrote your PIN on the back of your card in grease pencil, or that you had a little note in it that said, my PIN is this number, or even disguised as a phone
number. Do people really do that?
People are dumb. People have trouble remembering those numbers. You get into a panic in the store, and all the people are behind you, and they're pushing them. You know, this guy's such a jerk. You know, you're liable to actually want to look through your wallet and find that number. But don't do it, because doing that, the banks can say, you consented to that. Same thing if you say to your neighbor, hey, I needed some milk. Here, take my card. Here's my PIN number. And the neighbor helps herself to another $200. The bank is going to say, too bad, so sad, you actually gave that number away.
What are some of the credit card scams that people should be aware of these days? Is it skimming? Is it I've seen this new one, the fraud department scam, where they actually call you. What are some of them that we should just be aware of and we'll be able to feel smart at dinner parties?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to start with is the little charges on your credit card. There have been scams where, you know, you'll see $3.99 in your credit card and your time is worth some money. It'll be some nondescript thing, something services. So you go, oh yeah, maybe I bought an ebook on Amazon. You don't think about it. But there have been bad guys who have set up small recurring charges like that to come up on people's bills. And if they do that, and all you need is, you know, a corrupt merchant account to make that happen, you can make millions of dollars off people who don't check their statements. So the first rule is look at your statement. If you don't agree with something, call the credit card company. If you really don't agree with it, get them to issue you a new card. It's not a big deal. They'll put one in the mail. You'll be without your card for a few days, but you know what the heck? You'll be safe.
Why isn't it easier to crack down on the bad guys and gals, given that these are merchant accounts that they've got set up?
Yeah, there are corrupt people in every business. So, you know, there have been things like fraud committed by a car dealership in Vancouver where they were photocopying people's driver's licenses and doing identity theft on them and stuff like that. So the answer is there are always going to be bad guys out there. And I go every year to the tech conferences, and it's amazing the kind of stuff that you see there. So, for example, one guy was showing how even chip and PIN can be compromised. It used to be, you know, there were skimmers on gas pumps and ATM machines. This guy has devised one that also manages to compromise the PIN number. And he gave a really funny tip, which is he said, make sure if you're using a self-serve gas pump, use one that's well lit and it's up near the guy who's the attendant for the gas station, because the bad guys have to open up the gas pump. They have a counterfeit key and slip their stuff in. They're more likely to do that where the guy can't see it. So I always go to the gas pump that's right in front of the window.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was just so it was, quote, closer to top up your coffee. You know,
well, there is that.
There is that, too.
So bad guys put that technology there. The weirdest one I heard about, and it's really not a great risk, is, you know, there are thermal imaging cameras now. In fact, for $250, you can buy an attachment for your smartphone that turns it into a thermal camera. And at least hypothetically, if somebody is behind you in line in the store and you've just typed in your PIN number, they can come up and take a picture of the pin pad, and there's enough heat left on plastic or rubber pin pads that they can get your number.
I'm going to carry refrigerated wipes in my wallet at all, in a cooler, so that I can just...
That's not a bad idea. A better idea is just lean your hand on a bunch of the keys, because then what happens is they all get warm and the guy can't
Right. You referenced that there's a difference in probability. So there are some scams that are, you know, are they really going to do that? And others that are quite common. How do you in your own life triage so that you're managing your behavior on the easy things like going to the best lit gas station, but also not becoming obsessed? Or maybe you're obsessed. Are you obsessed? Are you obsessed?
Well, a little bit obsessed, but you want to be careful, for example, if you go to online shopping, because you're not always sure who you're dealing with. So just to give you an example, there's a radar detector called Whistler, and there's a ski area called Whistler, you know, and they probably had some kind of disagreement over who owns Whistler.com. But if you go to a site that you don't recognize, or even worse, if that site solicits you in an email, you might be talking to some bad guys, and then you give your credit card, and you find out that actually it's not so good. In fact, I did actually look into that ski area, and I found that they actually print out your credit card numbers. You order some merchandise from them or something, there was a pile of things sitting there, and anybody could have taken away those credit card printouts and dealt with that. So sometimes it's just human stupidity or human carelessness that opens us up.
We've just got 1 minute left. What are your top three do this now tips to celebrate the spirit of Fraud Prevention Month? What would you have us do, mostly as it relates to our credit cards and to transacting in that way?
Well, on your email, which is pretty important, enable what they call two-factor authentication. So if a bad guy tries to go out and change your PIN number, you'll get a message on your phone. So that kind of trumps everything as everybody's top recommendation. The other one is be very, very suspicious. Okay, so if you're doing some business online and somebody wants your credit card number, make sure that you know it's really the Hudson's Bay Company and not somebody in Hudson's Bay or something like that. And you know, probably the third one is just if something sounds too good to be true, it is. So if somebody calls you up and wants your credit card number for that Caribbean cruise that's going to be free, it's probably not free.
It's probably not free. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Bruce.
Dr. Tom Keenan is a cybersecurity expert professor at the University of Calgary and the author of Techno Creep. Coming up next, millennials have access to technology that their parents could not have dreamed of 2 decades ago. With the arrival of Uber, hailing a cab is almost obsolete. What does the arrival of robo-advisors mean for the human version? I'll ask that question of our next guest. And we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Masterpiece Theater is for old people. Bus tours, liver and onions, jokes forwarded on email, all things for old people. But what about financial advisors? We've invited a relatively new financial advisor, a millennial, I can't even pronounce the word, a millennial financial advisor, to make his pitch for his people getting financial advice. Brandon Silberman, financial advisor at Manulife Securities Investment Services, Inc. Hey, Brandon.
Hi.
Why should a young person get a financial advisor?
When you're young, it's very important to start learning. Financial literacy is very important at a young age. Advisors can certainly help them start to navigate the path. Another important aspect is a lot of young people, recent grads, have group plans, group RSPs, group pensions through their employers and need help choosing the investments in them.
You don't work for free, at least as far as I know, and
no,
yet young people don't have a lot of money. Are they really worth serving as a client? I mean, I would think that if you're a young financial advisor in this economy, you're looking for 55 plus with 500 grand.
I look at it a different way, actually. I look at it on a household basis. We service a lot of millennials and younger clients that are often children or grandchildren of existing clients. That way, you don't have to justify on a per account basis. We also create a lot of long-term relationships with our clients and families. We service a lot of multi-generational families in specific industries. And getting to know the children early and helping them save and kind of position themselves, excuse me, for the future is a great business tool for us as well.
Because it can be a real churn when there is a death in a family, either to a spouse or to kids, that the money doesn't stay with the same advisor over time if you haven't laid that groundwork.
Absolutely. It's actually a big risk to a lot of advisors and their independent practices. The way we look at it is we want to get them to know them early on. We do a lot of estate planning in our office. A lot of life insurance and different planning regarding succession planning for the businesses, and getting to know them at an early age will help prevent the churn, so to speak, that you mentioned later.
I get it when you're servicing Gen 2. That makes perfect sense to me. You know, sure. The parents. The parents have big bucks. The kids don't. Who cares? Because they're either going to inherit or they're going to start making big bucks.
Correct.
What's the minimum asset level you need to see if a 27-year-old walks into your office and says, "Hey, I need a financial advisor"?
We don't look based on assets.
How do you determine whether or not it's worth the investment of your time and energy?
The great thing working with Manulife Securities is that since we're independent offices, independent business owners, I can decide who we deal with at what asset level. That's not the same everywhere else. Sometimes I sit across someone, let's say in the tech industry. My office is in Kitchener-Waterloo. There's a lot of startup companies and a lot of technology companies. There's a lot of promise in my client base based on future earnings. There's a lot of interesting businesses being built.
So what are the questions that you ask to determine whether or not that person who's got 50 right. grand in student debt and like $10,000 in a TFSA, how do you determine whether or not they're going to be a profitable client to you over their lifetime or not?
You can't always know for certain. I mean, I'll always take the meeting is how I look at it.
Yep.
Ask about their dreams and aspirations. The first meeting that I usually conduct with new clients or prospects is always just simply talking about where they are now and where they want to be. There's no product recommendations. I simply make notes and then I get back to them. And that's how I've always handled it. And it seems to be a great way to handle the younger client segments as well.
How do you compete against the robo-advisors?
Right. In our experience, especially dealing with multi-generational families, even though young people may not have a lot of assets to invest, they do need a lot of advice on life insurance, group benefits, their group RSP plans. A lot of things that robos, to this point, don't do effectively. I think my business has shown over the course of 5 or plus years that service is still important, and our older clients enjoy us personally meeting their kids and helping setting them up for a successful future.
How do you answer the fee question? So, back in my day,
sure.
when we watched Little House on the Prairie and all that stuff, fees was not a part of the discourse.
Right.
Now it is all, as journalists, we talk about it all the time.
Absolutely.
Clients probably come into your office and ask that question. So they
sure.
say, how am I paying for your services? What do you say?
Sure. Nobody works for free. I put that out there and clients understand that. I'm very upfront and transparent with all the costs involved on the investment side as well as on the insurance side. You have to be. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I went and I bought a new vehicle. I needed a new truck because mine broke down. I know exactly how much I paid for that vehicle at the time, and I wrote the check. I think it's very important on the investment side to kind of take that analogy going forward. Younger generations and millennials absolutely want to know. There's no hiding it. You have to disclose it.
And so what are you, a fee-based model, even for millennial clients who might have 10 grand, 20 grand?
So the way it works through Manulife Securities is that advisors truly have the options of choosing what compensation model they work with their clients. So we have commission or transaction-based models in my office, as well as fee-based clients, based on different factors, I can put them into each bucket.
So to someone with 20 grand and they come in and say, I want you to take on my business, how much would I pay?
So $20,000. So for example, in Canada, I think the average mutual fund is about 2.25%. No commission, I'd be making about 1% a year off that revenue prior to paying off any expenses in the business.
So you would say you've got 20 grand, you're going to be in mutual funds, it's going to be about 2.25%.
Right.
Which is, here's what
and
the dollar
here's
value
in dollars.
Is.
You have to legally express it in dollars. It's one of the improvements to, and a lot of changes to the industry lately, is that we have to plainly spell it out in dollars, which is a great asset to the advisors that do that. It builds a lot of trust. I mean, you can't get around paying for service. So
yeah. Yeah. What are the key things that millennials as a demographic need to focus on? And I know for our listeners, they may not be aware that millennials are actually old now. They're like in their 30s. They could be running companies. They have children. You know, they're well advanced.
Right. A lot of the old adages still ring true. You want to save and invest when you're young. The best day to invest was yesterday, so that your money can compound over time. The other part that I focus a lot in our office is on the estate planning and risk side. A lot of millennials, my friends are getting married, having kids. They need insurance. They need to think about the risks inherent in their daily life. That's very important. And that has not changed over time. Regardless of technology, it's still important to manage the risks.
Do you try and talk them out of spending $30,000 on a wedding?
Absolutely.
Are you married yet?
I am not.
So if you get married, can you promise me you won't spend more than $30,000 on your wedding?
Absolutely. I'll come back in for an interview and you can ask me all about it.
I will do an interview with you on how I was able to get married for under 10, and you will be amazed
at the
brilliance of that particular approach. Do you, and I know I ask this partly to be contentious and partly because I'm curious, will financial advisors exist in 20 years?
Absolutely.
Why?
The way I look at it, estate planning and managing risks is paramount in everybody's life, like I just mentioned earlier. I mean, life insurance, critical illness insurance, disability insurance, these are things people need, and they need someone to tell them that they need it. You don't want an instance.
But both those things can be done by other people. My estate plan can be a lawyer, and all my insurance needs can be an insurance broker. It doesn't need to be a financial advisor. It can be, but it doesn't need to be.
The way I would look at that is, advisors can help provide the estate planning with the cash flow and budget planning and the financial strategy in general. So whether you're doing your investing online yourself, self-directed, or have an advisor to do it, you're still investing, but you need someone to help you develop the plan and do the numbers for you and make sure you're on track. I mean, we've had numerous examples where clients started with the best intentions, but things happened in their lives. Maybe someone lost their job and they had to stop investing on a monthly basis. So the next review meeting, 6 months, a year later, I had to remind them, listen, you got a new job. You have to start investing again. We have to get the plan back on track. I mean, if you're doing it yourself, it takes a lot of discipline to remind yourself. I believe our profession does have a place for a long, long time.
Brandon, thanks for your time.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Brandon Silberman is a financial advisor at Manulife Securities Investment Services. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money, a little bit about life. Our guest, Raj Lala, president and CEO of Evolve Funds. And Raj, just the first thing that comes into your mind. You ready?
Sure.
By the way, your last name plus the name of my book, amazing. Moolala. Lala. Did you feel like it was a copyright infringement when you saw my book? Thinking, wait a second,
I own that. Well, imagine if I named my daughter Moo.
Yeah, you could.
I don't know. I don't
she
know
would
many
never
kids
forgive
that would
you.
Like the first I, name
she
Moo.
Would never forgive you.
Never.
So here is question number one. How would you describe your money personality?
I would say that I'm calculated, but I definitely take risks.
Twas ever thus? Was it always that way?
Yes.
Who is the biggest influence on you as it relates to your money personality and your money behavior?
My father.
How was he an influence?
He was the exact same way.
Really?
Yeah.
Were there consequences if you did not behave in that way growing up? Was there judgment?
He would call me stingy, or he would tell me that I'm not having enough fun out there. Yeah, it was very different.
Really? So it was not frugality.
He wasn't the kind of father that, you know, forced me to save and be super conservative with my money. His view was that you should be smart with it, but you should also enjoy it.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Watches.
Watches. How many watches do you have?
Not that many as I used to. Six.
Six, okay. And what is the one watch that you bought, and after you bought it, you had a bit of a freak out as to how much you spent on it?
My Rolex.
You bought a Rolex. Was there an occasion that led you to buy a Rolex?
I sold my first company.
And you thought, now's the time. I'm getting a Rolex. Yeah. Did you
know? And my dad told me.
Get a Rolex.
Yeah, go treat yourself to something good.
And you knew it was a watch and not a car?
Yes.
How did you know that?
Because I already had a car. I didn't need a second car.
All right. What do you plan to do when you retire? When will you retire and what will you do?
I'll never retire.
Why?
I just love working. I love building businesses. I love building a great team. I just don't see myself. I don't love golf. I don't love gardening. I do like traveling, but I think I can travel and I can continue to work. I just love the. I love being in the space.
What has been your worst financial mistake? Are you is the pause like I've never made one, or it's either I've never made one or it's so humiliating that I cannot speak about it publicly?
No, I mean, there's everyone always will have some examples. I would say mine was Briex. I bought some Briex way
Interesting. I'm glad before. I followed up with a supplementary question.
Yes.
And did you buy it like
before people started jumping off the helicopters and things like
right,
that.
Right, yeah. Right. So did you keep any evidence of that, like a share certificate or anything, if you framed it as a cautionary tale?
I never got a share certificate.
You should have.
I wonder if I actually ever owned it.
You should buy one on eBay and put it somewhere in your office.
A bearer certificate. Could,
it's probably worth like 1,000 times more than what the shares were worth.
Exactly.
What is one money topic you could write about, talk about, get interviewed about every single day without getting tired of it?
Structuring investment products and how to distribute them.
Wow. What is one topic you wish you never, ever, 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 ever had to talk about when it comes to money?
Options trading.
Really? How come?
The derivatives market is so complicated, and it's really an acquired taste to actually appreciate.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
I find not enough people put their money where their mouth is.
Ah, so matching up their values with how they invest.
Yeah.
Do you worry that people who do that are not going to get the returns that they would if they just let the market be efficient and even if there was some dirty money to be made?
I just think that some people say the right thing, as in they know that it's the most socially acceptable thing to say.
Right.
As it relates to a belief system.
Yeah.
But they don't back it up with their wallet.
Okay.
Or their investments.
All right. Well, thank you for your time and insight on that, Raj. Appreciate it. Raj Lala, President and CEO of Evolve Funds. That's it for our program today. Thank you very much for joining us. To listen to past episodes, there's a bunch of options. You can head on over to iTunes and download the podcast. You can also go to moolala.ca and listen to the entire show from beginning to end. Or you can pick and choose the segments that you would like to listen to. That's all an option for you. You can also send us your questions or comments to ask@moolala.ca. At Bruce Selry on Twitter, Facebook is Bruce Selry Moolala. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great day.